Hi, I'm Francisca Rojas. I'm a researcher with the Transparency Policy Project at the Kennedy School at Harvard. And this is Frank Hebert, who works at Open Plans in New York. And our session's about communities of transparency and looking at open data in action. And it's really about kind of understanding what makes it work, why, and how we can improve existing systems with what we've learned. My perspective is coming from research, and so I've been researching a couple of open data projects, and Frank's perspective is really coming from the field, from working with cities and trying to implement these initiatives. So I'll go first, and then Frank, and we're each going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then we're really eager to hear from all of you because we know there's a lot of experience in the room as well. So hopefully we can leave the last half hour for questions and discussion. Okay, so today I'm going to share with you insights on the effectiveness of two recent transparency innovations. One is on transit transparency, and the other is on recovery spending transparency. With these examples, I hope to share with you some insights on what works, what doesn't, why the difference, and how we can design better transparency systems moving forward, particularly using technology to move this forward. So the first innovation we've been studying is transit transparency. In the past 5 years, more and more transit agencies have been establishing public APIs that allow developers to access timetables, real-time locations, and predicted arrival times for their buses and trains. And this is allowing third parties to do really clever things with the information. And this is one example from Boston, but there's a lot of other ways of getting this information that kind of adapt and meet a lot of variety of user needs. The second innovation is the unprecedented transparency around the Recovery Act spending, where almost 300,000 recipients of federal funds had to report on all of their expenditures on a quarterly basis over the span of 2 years. And the government set up the recovery.gov website to allow the public to track all of this money. And all 50 states actually followed suit as well. So there was a federal level recovery website, but all 50 states also had portals for this information. So broadly speaking, these two examples share certain commonalities. They're both open data, right? So they provide machine-readable, non-proprietary ways to download this information for the public to do whatever they want with the data. They also fall under the tenets of open government. So it involved public agencies at the federal, state, and local levels making a decision to actually make this information about their internal functions public so that others could derive public benefit from the data. And both systems also involve really complex information that requires pretty sophisticated technical skills to work with. But where the commonalities end is that they both have pretty different outcomes as the systems have matured over the past couple of years. So what explains the difference is going to be kind of the rest of this talk. So in transit, we've seen transformational change. We've gone from getting information about buses and trains from timetables that are indecipherable, that were difficult to read, difficult to understand, and didn't necessarily reflect reality, right? Buses and trains don't often adhere to schedules. And so today, right, we have dynamic, location-aware, mobile interfaces that tell us where the bus is, when it's going to arrive at our particular stop. This is really useful information because the biggest barrier to people riding transit is wait times. And we're seeing in our research that this information really is reducing the amount of time people are waiting for transit. But when it comes to tracking the stimulus, which amounts to almost $300 billion of spending, we have really little sense of the impact that this money made in our communities. Despite of the availability of data that is unprecedented in scope and in depth, this is a map that was done by Edward Tufte with recovery spending data. And really the only thing it tells us is that money went to all the populated places in the US. We really have no sense about whether it addressed economic needs, what kind of people got the recovery jobs. That information wasn't in the recovery spending data. And so what accounts for these differences? Well, it's think it's a tale of data supply and data demand. It's about data push versus data pull. And so the transit story is one of data demand. It begins with techies, like a lot of you in this room, who wanted access to train and bus information. And they wanted to inform their own personal commute, so they started screen scraping transit websites and tailoring the information to, you know, whatever bus line they were riding. By scraping the websites and writing code, they started to build apps. And the transit agencies started noticing and realizing that there was real value in information that they were using internally themselves to manage their fleets. And this process was actually made easier because a standard came about, a data standard evolved, primarily to meet the demand from Google Transit, but also a service like NextBus also existed that was providing arrivals predictions for buses using the GPS traces that agencies already were collecting. And Portland's TriMet was the first agency to release their data. And the story really is one of data demand, where there was the agency put up a web service where you could kind of query your bus and it would tell you when the next bus would arrive. But the interface was really clunky and you could only query one bus at a time. And a developer and a commuter started scraping this data and built his own app because he had a choice between three different buses at any given time that were, you know, whose stops were a couple blocks away. And so he built an app for his trio where that would let him compare the three buses, because this was before the iPhone. And he also happened to be a transit activist and knew people inside the agency and learned that there was one engineer inside the agency who's now known as the godmother of open data. Her name is Bibiana McHugh, who was also trying to, you know, push the data out. And, he gave me this really great quote during our research. He said, Bibiana was pushing to get the data out, and I came along pushing to get in, and we broke through. And so this was really the first instance of open data in transit. And since then, a lot of other transit agencies across the U.S. have followed suit, initially releasing scheduled data. Those are the blue boxes. But then once this information was really understood to be very valuable, real-time data started being released by agencies. And so those are the red bubbles. And the outcome is, you know, today we have several hundred apps, customer-facing apps that, serve the needs of transit riders. They were built by developers at no cost to transit agencies. So that's a pretty transformational effect of open data. The recovery data, on the other hand, follows a supply model where all the recipients of government funds had to report on their spending. So it was, you know, the amounts of money they received, the projects they were using the money for, where the locations were, and how many jobs were being created. And, why was this money this data being made public? It was made public to build trust around the spending, right? So people would, you know where the money was going and that the money was being spent wisely and without waste. The assumption was that citizens would keep an eye on the stimulus, right, through these recovery websites, not just recovery.gov, but also the state websites. And many of these websites were designed with citizens in mind. So they, a lot of them have maps where you can type in your zip code and then look at all the projects around you. And the notion was that you would look around and be like, oh, wait, nobody's really building that. I'm going to, report it to the government. And some of the websites had a big button, big red button that said, report fraud, waste, and abuse. But our research shows that the public really wasn't doing this, and the ones who were going to the recovery websites were looking for jobs and were looking for contracts. They didn't really want information about the projects. They wanted to get involved and benefit directly. Another group that began to organize around stimulus information were advocates for social justice, but also for fiscal accountability. And they had a hard time actually engaging in the data because it was too complex. It was also unreliable because recipients were kind of self-reporting their expenditures. It was prone to errors, and also the data itself didn't tell advocates what they wanted to know, which was how were the expenditures addressing economic need, because in the recovery data collection process, there were no demographic indicators. So advocates couldn't answer the question, who's getting the jobs and are the neediest getting, you know, benefiting from the funds, because there was nothing to match up the spending data with need. And the process to do that was actually really difficult. You could think about, matching up the recovery data with census data to get the demographic component, but the recovery data was reported in zip codes and in states. And so the match was really difficult to do, to kind of translate it into a census tract. And then the third group that was also seeking value out of recovery data were journalists. And so journalists wanted to know whether the money was doing what it said it was doing. But like advocates, journalists also had a hard time engaging with this data. It was so complex that, as one of them told me, actually a reporter here in Texas, he's like, you couldn't go to a website, pull down the data, and file your story on deadline. You just couldn't. And so it was, also on its own, the data was kind of not as meaningful as you want it to be because the demographic part was missing. And so it was really hard to pull stories out of the information. And then the few journalists who actually did work with the data were very kind of focused, specialized media outlets. So they were either really focused on, being watchdogs or very focused on local impact. So kind of the local papers actually picked this up more than the national media. And so in the end, we got a lot of data, but not a lot of understanding out of Recovery Act transparency. And so not having enough demand, right, results in websites going dark. So California pulled its recovery website. So did a couple other states, Florida, Ohio, Kansas. Other state websites are still alive, but they don't really get a lot of traffic from the public. And then the few third-party apps that were built with recovery data stopped being updated within a year of the program going in place. So how do we improve transparency systems going forward? How do we take the lessons from these two examples and learn from them? I think there's three questions that we need to ask of any kind of open data initiative. What's the problem we're trying to solve? Is the data that we want to put out there relevant to solving that problem? And who are the stakeholders who need to be involved in making those decisions and really identifying the needs and the data? So here, when we kind of think about the type of problem, we see that transit and recovery are fundamentally two different types of problems. The transit data is, fulfills an individual need. I want to catch the bus. And the data that's available, right, the bus is coming in 2 minutes, fills that information gap. Whereas the recovery spending, the type of problem was generating jobs and creating and ensuring accountable spending. And this is more of a collective need. And it's a tougher problem. It's a collective action problem. To help us think about this a little bit more, what's the counterpart in each example? So the individual need in recovery spending was getting a job. And actually, people did go to the recovery websites to get that information. The collective need in transit is getting all of the buses running on time so that you don't need to know where the buses are. The system is reliable. So the next question is relevance of data, and let's stay with the transit example. So imagine if transit agencies had only released on-time performance instead of the actual locations or the arrival predictions of buses. And initially in Boston, this is what happened. The person who was responsible for opening the data at the MBTA was tasked with doing the performance report card for the MBTA. And in the process of putting that information together, realized that all the engineers inside the agencies could see every single bus on their BlackBerries. And he's like, well, why can't, the riders have this information too? Okay, so he puts out the on-time performance. And what can you do with this information, right? You would know that, on the Newburyport line, 64% of trains arrive on time. I have a 64% chance of catching my train. What would you have to do to get to the level of certainty in your commute that you do now with real-time data? Well, you would have to organize. You'd have to advocate with other transit riders to, you know, take this information, lobby the transit agency. The transit agency would then have to kind of put pressure on the system operators to then improve the transit service to get to 100% reliability to the point where the timetables actually tell you, you know, reflect reality and tell you when the bus is going to arrive. So in essence, the transit example has been really successful, first because it fulfills an individual need with a type of information that fills that gap, right? It gives you a prediction of when a bus is going to arrive at your stop or when, you know, or where a bus is at any given point in time. But there's a third critical part to the transit story, and that's this notion of the community of transparency. And so a community built up around the transit data that involves three main actors. First is the agency as the discloser of data. Second are the software developers as the intermediaries of the information. They're the ones who took the real-time feeds and transformed them into apps that then transit riders could use to get the information they needed about their commute. And the transit riders, as the users of information, also have a role to play in this because they give the developers feedback on what's working and what's not working in the apps. And then the developers, because they have relationships with the agencies, can filter that information back to the government to improve the data, to improve the system. And I think, you know, another lesson in this little chart is that the government or whoever the discloser of information is, because it could also be a private entity, doesn't have to do all the work themselves. They don't have to build the entire transparency system from beginning to end. They can be really strategic about who they engage in actually, you know, being the stakeholders who propel the system forward, who has the motivation to work with this information and deliver it to the people who can benefit from the information. So the equivalent in recovery, the equivalent process in recovery looks a little bit like this, where the federal government and the states acted as intermediaries, and the end users actually ended up being public officials themselves. So for them, the spending information was really valuable because they had to get the money out really quickly. It was all use it or lose it money, and it was the first time where they had a view of federal spending as it flowed through their state. And so with this data, they were able to kind of make spending more efficient and more effective and not lose any money. On the other hand, it was a little bit more difficult for journalists and advocates to filter the information to other advocates because often, issue advocates have other advocates as their end users, as their audience, but also back to citizens in really making the story of stimulus impact clear. Okay, so what are the considerations in designing effective transparency systems? I would say there's five. First, identify the audience for the information. Engage the stakeholders in identifying what the meaningful data is. So, you know, had they known that advocates really needed to, I mean, actually the advocates did tell the recovery board that they really needed demographic information, but there was already so much data that the government was collecting from recipients of stimulus that they're like, we can't ask them to report any more information. But they could have also asked, you know, done an automatic, translation from a zip code to a census tract, and then you can actually link it to demographics a lot easier. Reflect the user needs in the content and the format, and that goes to that previous point. What's meaningful data, and how do I deliver it to the users in ways that they can work with it and actually add value from it? And then determine, actually, if the intermediaries play a role in your system, and what role do they play? And then integrate those feedback loops. So, open channels of communication so that transparency can adjust, learn from the user needs, from the users themselves. And so in the transit case, the most successful agencies have been the ones who have actively fostered and forged relationships with their local developer community, both online and offline. And so there's Google groups, right, where a lot of software developers and, you know, a point person within the agency where they kind of troubleshoot the data. But also they meet offline, right? There's meetups. They some of the agency champions in transit actually know all of the developers' all of their names, and they take them out to lunch, for example. And that's how you keep a system sustainable. It's about the relationships. Okay, and now Frank is going to take us to the city and give us some real on-the-ground battle stories about what it's like to implement all of this at a local scale. Thank you.
Thanks. So I don't know about battle stories, but so I work at the sort of intersection of cities and technology. So I'm interested in making cities, and I'm interested in making tools to make cities better. And I guess right now I would describe myself as a little underwhelmed, possibly even a little disappointed with the rate of change that we're getting in this space. So cities have amazing problems, and technology offers this amazing range of solutions, and yet I'm still hoping that we can do a little more than we have so far. So I'm going to try and explain where my disappointment comes from, the root causes for that disappointment, and then I don't want to be too much of a downer, so I also have some possible things that collectively we can do to kind of realize this potential for technology making better cities. So I guess I'm curious as to a sort of like a show of enthusiasm for this concept, the TED Prize for the City 2.0. Is that enthusiasm or is that a lack of enthusiasm? Okay, so some of you, all right, okay, great. So this is my take on it. What does it mean? Nobody knows what it means, but it's provocative. It gets the people going. I'm not sure it's provocative. I'm not sure it gets the people going. I am pretty sure that nobody knows what it means. This is a project that the New York City DOT, woo, worked on with Open Plans last year. This is an amazingly successful project from the point of view of the city. 40,000 people helped them with siting the new bike share program. 8,000 locations were suggested. Lots and lots of visitors every week. Tons of good press. This is the cutting edge of involving people in shaping their cities. And there are other examples I could use. Change by Us is another project that, you know, has similar aspirations but only gets so far. So I guess where is the cycle? Where is the feedback loop? Where is the actionable aspect of projects like this? Are we actually changing cities? Are we actually making cities better? Sort of fixing the big substantial problems that they have? I'm not sure. So, why? Well, here are some ideas about cities. What's this? Does anyone know what this is? Does nobody know what this is? So this is the city limits of Austin. Is anyone from Austin? I guess not. Okay. Okay, come on, people. So this is the shape of Austin physically on the map. And it also kind of captures some of the complexity. So within this very strange shape, 800,000 people, 20% of whom live below the poverty line, there's a lot of complexity both in the organization of the city and also of the things that go on within it. And cities are, I guess, what some people like to call wicked problems. So while it's amazing that we have transit data that we can get on our phones, in hindsight, that seems like quite an easy problem to fix. And no, I'm not dissing the good people who worked hard to make that happen. But cities have these really big, difficult problems. Cities themselves are not monolithic. So within a city, there's lots and lots of departments and organizations and subgroups and factions and different levels of elected representation, and we could talk about that for a really long time. But so cities have wicked problems. Cities are extremely complex. And then maybe most importantly, there are a lot of cities. So how big is the population of the U.S. right now? Yeah, it's like 315, 314 million. What share of those people live in cities? Well, okay, so if this is a... So this is from 0% to 100%. Like, tell me where... Which way should I go? Yeah? Okay, that's pretty good. Yeah, 80%. Oh, thank you. Cool. So then... And so then think of like the really big cities where a lot of the kind of open city data action is happening, like the New Yorks, the Chicagos, Boston. Let's say like the top 10, 15 largest cities in the country, what share of the total population do they represent? Again, tell me where I should go. 60? So I guess am I in the right place? Left or right? My left or your left? Okay, I'm going to get this way. I think you want me to go this way. How far? Much further, or am I right? Oh. Okay. So those are like the relatively large cities, and they're actually only about 7% of the population. So between 7% of the population and 80% of the population are pretty small places. 30,000 municipalities where you have elected representatives and some kind of home rule going on. And it varies a lot around the country, whether it's counties and all sorts of things. But basically, there are tons and tons of cities out there. And so that is, I think, one of the third reason that I'd offer why it's really hard to use technology to fix cities. And then finally, on the ground in cities, information travels really slowly. So I don't know how many people know every block. Woo! Yeah, so every block is great. Every block takes lots of public data feeds and serves them up for you by your neighborhood boundary, by your zip code, and so on. It's amazing when you talk to people who don't work in technology, who aren't in news, who aren't in media, but are on the ground in communities, how few people have heard of this service that will take all of this data, aggregate it up for you, and present it every day in an email. Like, the speed of information transfer within cities about really useful tools is really, really poor. And so those factors sort of create this perfect storm of the potential of technology that is as yet unmet. And so I want to offer some kind of hopeful suggestions. And then I'm really curious to, I hope nobody else is as pessimistic as me, and maybe I'm putting this pessimism on today to make this, you know, a little more interesting. But so I think the first thing we have to do as technology makers, people who care about cities, people who want to make better places, is we have to make some critical decisions. Like, who are we serving? What tools do we want to be building? What problems are we trying to solve? Can we push ourselves to tackle more difficult problems? Are we able to go out there and reach people who don't have the tools that maybe they need, but we have the capability of building those tools? So it's kind of maybe a little hand-wavy, but I think we need to think about kind of what our values are and how that might help us choose tools. This is a wonderful kind of, I guess, axiom from the news industry. Like, you want to do a press release, you want to get people's attention, has to have all three of these things. It has to be scary, it has to be local, and it has to be urgent. And that gets people excited, right? So you're doing something that is scary, it's relative to them, and it's going to happen really soon. And there's lots of problems that cities have that maybe don't quite meet all of these three. And so we need to be building tools that are actionable, that address these three things at once. And if we can build tools that give people a loop closer, that help them then go back to their government and engage, we're on that. So I guess maybe rather than scary, local, and urgent, you could think like, if it bleeds, it leads. You could also say, if it's parking, it's sparking for public meetings. I don't know how much you like that one. And then the third one they jotted down on the plane was, if it enrages, it engages. So, like, what can we do to get people the tools that engage with the issues that actually get them worked up? So, values, doing actionable tools, government. So I won't put people who work for government on the spot by making them stand up. But I think we should work really hard to love our government. Love your gov. So there are people in government who are doing really cool work, and we need to find those people. We need to glom onto them. We need to build them the tools that they need. They are ultimately the people who can implement. They're the people who are taking your tax. They're the people who are laying your tarmac. They're the people who are building your bike lanes and your light rail. We need to be integrated with those people, and we can help them. And there are really good examples. There are really good talks coming up here this weekend about the work that the Code for America fellows do. They're a great example of boosting the power of government. There are also some CTOs in government who are doing a panel later. So government, we need to work with it. So I guess the one perspective is the like getting government small enough to drown it in the bathtub. And I also want to get into a bathtub, but I want to smother government with loving rather than drowning it. Procurement. So the flip side of working with government. This is, again, something that we collectively need to be really aware of and we need to tackle. So procurement is the purchase of technology and services by government. Do we want to be the little fish while beneath the surface the big fish carry on making reasonably okay software for government, maybe not so good sometimes, and taking millions and millions of dollars for it? Or do we want to be building really great tools? Do we want to be the froth, or do we want to be the milkshake? Do you want to be the root beer, or do you want to be the float? So, most specific, what we can do and what we can advocate for are standards. And so, if you think of standards as taking all of the different potential channels of communication and consolidating them, standardizing them, standards basically increase the surface area between government and citizens. And so the more that cities are using standards in their work and the more that they're communicating with citizens via standards, the more opportunities there are to plug into those processes. And so the example that I give here is a project that I think some people in this room are probably pretty familiar with, but Open 311. So how many people live in a city with a 311 service? How many people called 311 in the last month? Cool, okay. So I should do that as well. So Open 311 provides a standard for those channels of communication. So primarily it's like a service reporting. You need a request, you need to report something to city, the city needs to get back to you with a service. But if you think of it as a standardized channel for all sorts of communication between citizens and government, it gets really powerful because those cities, those 30,000 small complex places we talked about, they can all use the same tools and they can all talk to each other in the same language. And the apps that work in one place will work in another. The same app will work no matter which municipality you happen to be commuting through that day. The tools that a mayor can put on their desk in one city will work on the desk of a mayor the other side of the country, a dashboard to see what's going on. So standards are really, really important. And the more that we can adopt them in our work, the more we can promote them, the more we can encourage our cities to use them, potentially we get one step closer to actionable tools. And then finally, you should spend the rest of this weekend finding the really awesome government talks. So I guess I'm not going to read out the whole list, but I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. I feel a little bit like I'm giving you horse racing tips here. But so I recommend on Monday at 12:30, the CTO panel with John Tolver, Rachel Stern, and several other cool people. If you're interested in the kind of hacking and hackathon engagement side, so whether you want to think of that as like the first step or the froth on the milkshake, or there are panels coming up about that tomorrow, 5 p.m. with Aaron Ogle. And then on Monday at 5 p.m., awesome.gov, the G-Men, also caught my eye as a very interesting panel on this topic. So I guess we're going to stop talking now. We'd really like to hear your thoughts and particularly your pushback, maybe, against some of the things that we've said. Thanks.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you so much for both of your talks. They're very, very interesting, so thank you for coming out here. I guess my question is just to follow up, Frank, on what you said about standards and standardizations. I think that's a really important point, and I think it's a really huge challenge. I'm also from New York, and I have a few friends who work in the education sector, and there's a really huge consulting company that's gotten tons of money from the Department of Education, millions and millions of dollars. I think they were actually bought out by Fox most recently. And the reason why they got all the contracts is because they've been building up expertise, putting on platforms for the Department of Education, and the city doesn't have that expertise, so they've been more than willing to keep working with them. And I can't see any reason for that consulting firm whatsoever to function in any standardized platform, because it's not in their interest whatsoever. They want to maintain those exclusive contracts, and the city, meanwhile, doesn't have the expertise, and nor are they building up their expertise, because they keep contracting out. They're not building internal talent. So while you could do these little hackathons for things that are standalone tiny projects, for large-scale things like the big fish that you're talking about, if government continues to contract out, they're not going to build up those standards, and they're not going to build inside expertise. And that's terrible business planning. If you were launching a business, you would not want to contract out for this core function of what you should be doing. So I just wonder if any cities have kind of jumped over that. I don't know. I just don't know where to go with that one.
Yeah. So I guess the important term here is kind of vendor neutrality. So it's okay for the Department of Ed to go with that particular supplier, but the tools that they're getting need to be vendor neutral, so if they get fed up with being gouged by them, they can switch. And so I think that's like a really critical piece of this. And most of us don't have like much surface area onto procurement as a problem, but we need to be, I think, mindful of it in what we're doing. And then there are people working to try and fix this. So there's a project called civiccommons.org, which comes from Code for America and Open Plans. And one of the pieces of that project is trying to catalog all of the options for government purchasing. So just creating some kind of visibility and light in this space. Do you want to add something?
I can add to this. So the transit story actually starts with a situation much like what you're describing. You know, in my presentation, I made it sound really easy that, you know, the transit agencies just came along and opened up the vaults. And it really didn't happen that way. It was actually a lot of, you know, advocacy work done by techies putting pressure on the agencies to release the data and saying, you know you have it. Why can't you just give it to us? And the reason why the agencies couldn't just give it to them is because they were tied up in all these, you know, proprietary contracts with vendors. I mean, the transit space, I think probably like the education space, is pretty small. It's captured by very few vendors, and the agencies don't have the internal capacity to actually you know, complete those functions on their own. And so it took a lot for the agencies to actually be advocates on their own behalf and tell the contractors to say, you know, we need this data in an open format because we want to put it up on Google Transit. And oh, by the way, we also want to release it to all these developers who want to do really cool things with it. And it actually took, you know, like in Boston, it took like 3 years for the agency to be able to put out its data because they didn't own the rights to their own bus line shape files that they had themselves had drawn over a proprietary map, because in the contract at the time, they didn't think they would need to put that in the contract. And so a lot of agencies had to rewrite their contracts with vendors, understanding now that having kind of an open data standard is necessary to kind of, you know, let the public, you know, developers or whatever, you know, be the extension of their mission, right? Letting others use the information to produce public benefit for their, you know, for transit riders. But it's incumbent upon the government itself to recognize the value of this information, that they need to own it themselves, and then they need to negotiate that with the vendors.
Hello, thank you for your contributions here. It's been very useful for me. I'm a developer, but I have a keen interest in this topic, and I was just wondering, I've done some things that are similar to what the two things that you guys have made examples of, much more small scale for private organizations. And there's a lot of information about, to me, that first example of the bus is more of a customer self-service as a category of functionality, and that's something that is pretty well understood. And then the second piece of that is really about governance and making sure that people understand kind of business intelligence so that the owners of this recovery know what's being used. And then you mentioned, Frank, the issues of the grand challenges and how to solve them. And that's really more about informing your owners and, you know, making sure that people have interaction channels to actually, and maybe re-engineering processes and things of that nature. Is there thought about using the body of work that has been built up in the private sector about those things kind of categorized as in that way to address these in a more holistic way that isn't so, you know, just up to the people getting inspired and things of that nature? Thank you.
I guess there's a lot of private sector expertise within government. So I wouldn't say that like this is the only path to salvation is citizens doing it themselves. There's, you know, governments have deep benches of talent and consulting expertise that they can draw on. And so it's more of a like a fusion, I think, of those skills with the potential of outside talent and software development that people in this room can bring. So I don't think it's one or the other. And I'd say actually rather than kind of private sector expertise, the thing that we shouldn't lose sight of is the importance of politics and the way that decisions get made. And if we think that we can fix everything just by building the right tools, we're kidding ourselves.
Hi, to that end, around the politics side, I do a lot of hacking on my local town in Watertown, Massachusetts, and I've been spending about the past year and a half trying to, you know, push through a lot of these same kind of issues. I fall into the 93%. I'm a small town, 32,000 people. Most cities and towns are actually around like 5,000 to 7,000 in the United States. And one of the questions that I had around these big fish problems around the procurement systems and interacting with the existing vendors, I'm curious to hear from both of you about this. Are there any models of legislation for local government around this to bake in these kind of standards into the procurement processes? And then I'm just going to point out another one of the big fish, which is the ERP systems that these cities and towns rely on. As an example of like how much this costs these small cities and towns. One of the towns where my father was a city manager, their local budget was $8 million. And to implement one of these enterprise resource management tools was about a $200,000 implementation cost and then about a $100,000 ongoing licensing cost for, this is a small town of 5,400 people. And these are big, expensive tools. And so I'm just curious to hear from both of you and other people in the audience about, you know, are there models of legislation that local cities and towns have been using to kind of influence the direction of the procurement process?
I mean, I think the only one that comes to mind is in San Francisco, where I think they passed legislation saying that everything that the city procures has to be open source software. That's the only one. I don't know if anybody else in the room can kind of address his question.
There's not that much in the way of procurement. We're pretty much, I'm with the Center for Politics and Governance at UT, but we're pretty much at the mercy of vendors. On the other hand, as far as small cities and websites, Manor, Texas has done some really interesting work, and the city of Austin has a new website that's gloriously now up, and that was open source, was used specifically so that other cities could replicate it.
I think there are some efforts to draft model language for RFPs to include, at least keeping open source on the table as an option. And I guess the other note just on sort of small town systems is it's really interesting to look at places that have a strong research university focus. So like Bloomington, Indiana has done amazing stuff because they've had really strong ties to the academic institutions in the town, and they've been able to build out systems themselves that then saves them a lot over the years on license fees. So they have a lot of homegrown stuff that they're now thinking about open sourcing, which is really cool.
Well, as the representative of one of the big fish here in the crowd, my name is Phil. I work for IBM. A couple of things I wanted to reply to. First of all, there are some standards work that we're heavily involved with, things like CAP events, Common Event Protocol. That's one format by which we use to be able to receive events generated by all kinds of instrumented endpoints, things like traffic cameras, you know, manhole covers and streets, things like that. So we're strongly trying to advocate the use of CAP formats as a standard. The other one is Traffic Management Data Dictionary. That's another area where we're trying to push for standards in the space to be able to expose traffic information and traffic data in a standardized format. But to your question, sir, that you were asking about legislation, this is not going to be a legislative answer, but what we found, particularly working with smaller cities, is a pattern where groups of cities are banding together to share IT resources like we've never seen before. So, you know, coming from IBM, you know, we service a lot of government and banking customers, which tend to be the most conservative technology-wise in terms of adapting to change. But one of the biggest forms of change we've seen is more and more cities wanting to share IT resources and looking at SaaS and cloud models to be able to afford complex software that it's expensive because there's just it does a lot of stuff. So wanted to, you know, reply on those things, and there's a lot of interesting activity going on in the space. One more point. The research area, the cities with universities, are also good examples of where change can happen, where change can be affected more readily.
I love IBM because everyone who goes to an airport sees this fantastic advertising about making cities better, and that's just creating this wonderful market for open source tools. Get people excited about these potentially cheaper and more open alternatives, but it's being paid for by IBM's advertising budget.
Hi, I have a question about when we start talking about opening up data, particularly from technologies that are observational and use identification, I think that the sort of the issue that rides right behind transparency is always privacy. And while in no way did I suggest that we should continue this model, I think a lot of privacy advocates will tell you that in many cases we have privacy and security by obscurity right now, that there's an awful lot of data that's out there, but the only saving grace is that it's sort of hard to get to. And so I wonder if it sounds like there's what is a sound advocacy for private standard development, that demand side model that you were talking about in terms of building the tools, you know, that request the data. Where do you see the burden of privacy falling? Is that a legislative scenario where then government agencies and things of that nature who own the data need to be concerned about the privacy? Or is that something that we as tool developers should also build in by design?
You know, I think it's both. We've been trying to, as part of our transit research, is, you know, we've really been trying to understand the kind of transit rider response to actually having this information. And so we've been working with some software developers, and you know, a lot of the developers, when they built their transit apps, didn't build in any analytic capabilities into the transit apps at all, because they were just interested in kind of processing the information and delivering it to people, mostly delivering it to themselves. That's kind of a nice part of the transit example, is that the overlap between the end user and the intermediary is actually, you know, it's pretty close. But that aside, so we've been working with them trying to get user data off of their apps. And so some of them have built in the analytic capabilities, and we're finding that we're like, oh, you know, as researchers, we're having to deal with the privacy issue because, you know, we have IP addresses for people using these transit apps, right? And there isn't kind of any privacy notice on the apps or things like that. So I think on the developer side, when you're thinking about who's actually using this information, how are they using it, do you also have this kind of capacity to also, you know, tangentially be capturing a lot of personal information? That's about as much as I can answer from my experience.
I just add that I think a lot of the data that is not yet open in cities absolutely falls into that category. And so, you know, information that housing advocates and education advocates would really like to see is sort of behind the line from the perspective of a city, because that falls into, you know, it gets close to databases of people who are getting assistance or of kids, and that makes it really hard to consider opening up any of that data, even though that's something that, you know, to take the example of like housing related data, that could really kickstart local advocacy and engagement.
I was thinking about your Recovery Act example, and I was wondering if you ever feel that your approach is rather naive because there are so many contractors and interested parties who seek to shelter the source of their business. Is that too obscure?
Yeah, could you be a little bit more specific?
Graft. I just wonder how we could get more involved with the journalism profession so that the obstacles to openness can be explored in more depth.
Right. So, I think the journalism story is really tragic, right? Because they're the ones who are best positioned to be using this information to hold government spending accountable. But because, you know, so with the reporters that I talked to, they said, you know, the way that the media industry is now, you don't have time to spend with the data, right? So with one reporter, she said she spent like 3 weeks just playing around with a spreadsheet to try to understand what the patterns were. It took her like 7 months to file a story because she, you know, I mean, it's not like she was dedicating all her time to it. She was also having to, you know, do daily reporting on other things. She was a State House reporter. But, you know, she was actually allowed, because it was a smaller paper, to spend time with the data. But a lot of journalists can't afford to spend that time with the data. And because the data was so complex and unreliable, it actually took a lot of back and forth between journalists and the recovery leads at the state, a lot of back and forth to even interpret it and to troubleshoot it. And journalists just don't have that kind of time. And so I think it's really, you know, important to make the, you know, to really target who your intermediary is going to be, and in the type of information you put out and the format that you put it out, make it as easy as possible for them to use it. Now, you know, do they really want to do that? You know, it's probably, you know, who knows? I can't say to what extent this was done on purpose, but I think that certainly if you're thinking about how intermediaries can kind of propel, you know, this information forward to citizens, it's important to make it as easy for them and meet their needs, and to actually, you know, have those channels so you understand what their needs are. And I was going to say one more thing, but it just escaped me. But I mean, that's really what's been the most surprising about the recovery story, is that even journalists. Oh, and then this is the other thing, right? Is that at least on the advocacy side, right? The advocates were really wanted to tell the positive story of all the good impact that the spending was having, because money was going to programs that really had no money. And they had a hard time telling the positive story as well, because the information was so hard to work with. So even, you know, even if you think about it on the other side, it was also a disappointment.
What other kinds of data would you like to see opened up and exposed to the public? Is there some low-hanging fruit that you just see a high demand for, or is it just everything?
I think it's really useful to think about kind of what's the individual need type data, because that's the easy stuff. That's the low-hanging fruit. That's where the information gap can be narrowed really easily, because you don't need to kind of work with other data sets. You don't need to organize around it and advocate around it. And so... You know, another type of information that's like transit is like the health department ratings of restaurants. So like in LA and New York, you have like restaurants get rated A, B, or C depending on their health inspection information. And that's like transit, where it kind of, it's like what Frank was saying, it's scary, local, and urgent, right? You're making a decision at that point in time about whether or not to eat at a restaurant, and you don't want to get sick. And that's like that. I think a lot of most other problems are the collective action problems, and those are a lot tougher. So when I was interviewing developers for my transit research, I was like, what other kind of data would you love to have? And they're like, well, you know, crime data would be really useful. But crime data is one of the collective action problems, and in and of itself doesn't tell you much other than, okay, you're in maybe a not safe neighborhood, which you could probably tell without the data. I don't know, Frank.
So I think I have a kind of a theory about the popularity of transit data with developers, which I think Francesca already mentioned, which is like transit riders and software developers are the kind of the Venn diagram, the circles almost entirely overlap. And software developers like trains because they run on a fixed schedule, and you know, they fit with like a particular worldview. And human services data is a lot harder to kind of grok and to deal with, and it's actually potentially more transformative. So data on homeless populations, education data, low-income housing, like there's a lot of information out there, but we software people don't kind of get into it with the same excitement. And so I think the solution is we need to go and talk to more people who are kind of on the ground. So we need to go and talk to more community organizers and talk to more established organizations who work in particular spaces, so homeless services, housing, etc. And they know what the problems are. And we can say, oh, well, there's probably a way you could take that data set and do this and this and this. And suddenly you've given them a new tool for their toolbox that they never had before.
So on the recovery side, some of the interviews I did with advocate groups, they said, you know, this data would be really easy for, like, you know, a computer scientist to work with, and they could, you know, turn it around in like a second. But they don't have the substantive knowledge to know what, you know, to what end to use this information, right? So you really need to bridge the people who have the substantive knowledge with the people who have the capacity to work with the information and have them in conversation. Oftentimes they don't understand each other, so they really need to work together a lot and often and come with an open mind so they do understand each perspective and opportunity. We're at 4:30. Thanks, everybody, for all the great questions. We can talk later.